Maybe I learned a thing or two. We both did. I'd like to meet her sometime. I smiled. Of course, there was Boy Scouts, too.
You're a Boy Scout?
I nodded. The one freedom my dad gave me away from him. Figured it was training that I needed that he didn't have to give me. He dropped me off, picked me up.
How far'd you get?
I shrugged. She lowered her head, gave me a disbelieving look. You're one of those hawks or ospreys or something like that.
Come on, what's it called?
Eagle.
Yeah, that's it. Eagle Scout.
I got the sense that talking took her mind off the pain. She lay back and murmured, Guess we're about to find out if you really earned all those patches.
Yep.
I hit the power button, and the GPS unit flickered. A wrinkle appeared between her eyes.
Did they offer an electronics badge?
I tapped the unit. No, but I think it's just cold. You mind warming it up inside your bag? She pulled back the sleeping bag, and I set it gently on her lap. Electronics don't really like cold. Interferes with their circuits. Warming it up helps. Vince, my fiancé, wouldn't know the first thing about all this. If he'd been in this plane, he'd be looking for the nearest Starbucks and cussing the fact that there was no cell service.
She closed her eyes.
What I wouldn't give for a cup of coffee.
I might can help with that.
Don't tell me you have coffee.
I have three addictions. Running, mountains, and good hot coffee. And not necessarily in that order.
I'll pay you $1,000 for one cup.
The jet boil is seriously one of the greatest advancements in hiking technology, next to the compass. Maybe ever. Of course, the down sleeping bag is pretty good, too. I scooped snow into the jet boil and clicked it on while I dug through my pack looking for my Ziploc bag of coffee. The good news was that I found it. The bad news was that there wasn't much left, maybe a few days at best, and if we were conservative. I slid the bag out of my backpack. Ashley saw it.
Ben Payne, will you take a credit card?
A fellow coffee lover. It's amazing what we value when we're at our lowest. Jetboil makes an accessory that allows me to convert the canister into a French press. It only cost a few dollars, but I've used it 100 times and always marvel at its simplicity and how well it works. The water boiled. I measured and dumped in the coffee, let it steep, and then poured her a cup. She cradled it in her good hand, holding it just below her nose. The smile was genuine. It looked like, for a brief moment, she was able to push back on the world that was pushing down so hard on her. I was starting to learn that she used humor to ward off the pain. I'd seen other people do it. Usually something in their past had emotionally wounded them, and so they used humor or sarcasm to mask it, take their mind off of it. Her pain was growing, ramping up. I only had a couple of Percocet, but she'd need one tonight, and probably the next several nights. It had been 6 hours, so with numb fingers, I fumbled with the Advil top, poured 4 into my palm, and handed them to her. She swallowed and then hovered above her cup. She whispered, marking the moment. It's amazing the moment a cup of coffee will allow you. She passed the cup to me. I sipped, and she was right. It was good. She nodded at her attaché. If you reach in there, you'll find a bag of snack mix I bought at the natural snack store in the terminal. Filled with dried pineapple, apricots, and various types of nuts. It probably weighed 1 pound. I handed it to her. We both poured a handful and chewed slowly. I nodded. I believe this is the best snack mix I have ever tasted. I gave the dog a handful. He sniffed it, then inhaled it, wagging his tail and begging for more. He leaned against me and put his paws on my chest, sniffing the air. How do you tell a dog that he's not getting any more? She laughed.
Good luck with that.
I gave him one more small handful, and when he returned a third time, I pushed him off me and said, No. Dejected, he turned his back on me and curled up at the foot of Ashley's sleeping bag. We sat in the silence for a long time, drinking the entire pot. When we finished, she said, "Save the grounds, we can use them twice, and then, if we're desperate, we can chew on them."
"You're serious about your coffee?"
I touched the power button and the GPS flickered to life. "You got any kind of pad of paper in your briefcase?" She nodded. "Should be right in front." I pulled out a yellow legal pad and a pencil, found the screen that showed our location, and tried to copy the map as best I could, including the coordinates down to the minute. Once I had a relatively detailed drawing on par with a kindergartner, I said, "Be right back." I climbed up and out of our hole and compared the picture on the screen with that before my eyes, marking mountains and making mental notes of mountain crests and where they landed on the compass. That way, I knew north from south. Being lost is one thing. Staying lost is another. I might not have known where we were, but I could pick a direction and stick with it. I also knew the batteries wouldn't last forever, and whatever I could copy now would pay dividends in the days ahead. The more time passed, and the more our predicament sank in, the more concerned I became. Things were bad all around.
"You want the good news, or the bad?"
"Good."
"I know where we are."
"And the bad?"
"Our elevation is 11,652 feet, give or take 3 feet. The nearest logging road is over 30 miles and something like 5 mountain passes, I pointed. "That way. We're nearly 50 miles from the nearest thing that looks like civilization or a hard road, and to top it off, most of the snow out there is higher than I am tall."
She bit her lip, and her eyes wandered the white-walled cave. She crossed her arms.
"You're gonna have to leave me."
"I'm not leaving anybody."
"I can see the writing on the wall here. You can't get me out. You have a better chance alone. Give me the coffee, put those legs to work, and take my coordinates with you.
Bring a helicopter on your way back."
"Ashley, drink your coffee."
"Okay, but you've got to recognize that it's a distinct possibility."
Her eyes narrowed.
"Don't you?"
"Look, we need a fire, we need some food, and we need to lose a few thousand feet in elevation. Then we'll talk about what's next. One crisis at a time."
"But..."
She was strong. She had toughness that matters. The kind you can't get in school. Her tone changed.
"Let's keep the truth on the table where it belongs. It is a possibility."
"I am not leaving anybody."
The dog noticed my change in tone. He stood, walked up next to Ashley, and dug his head beneath her hand.
He still hadn't forgiven me since the trail mix episode.
She scratched his ears and his stomach growled. He looked over his shoulder at me, then slowly laid his head back down.
"I heard you. I know you're hungry."
We sat, listening to the wind pick up and rattle my tarp. I lay back into my sleeping bag, getting warm. I looked at her.
"Do you do that with all your friends?"
"What's that?"
"Prepare them for the worst?"
She nodded.
"If the worst is a possibility, then you keep it on the table. Don't hide from it. Don't run. It can happen. And if and when it does, you need to have thought about it ahead of time. That way, you're not crushed when your worst thought becomes your reality."
I jet-boiled more snow and made us both sip to keep our fluids up. If nothing else, it would help keep the hunger at bay. We napped on and off through the afternoon. The trail mix had taken the edge off our hunger, but food was a real problem, and I knew it. I couldn't function without it, and I needed energy to trudge through waist-deep snow to find it. Tomorrow would not be easy, maybe the toughest day yet. The pain in my chest was spreading. Night fell, as did the cold. With dusk leaving, I crawled out, shimmied beneath the snow and the lower limbs of a pudgy evergreen, gathered several handfuls of dead pine needles, twigs and branches, and piled them up beneath the wing. Doing this took 3 trips and left me gasping and clutching my ribcage for support. Ashley watched me with narrowed eyes. Grover's door was a single piece of some sort of sheet metal hanging by a single hinge. Probably didn't weigh 10 pounds. I pried it up using my foot, laid it flat beneath the wing, and then piled pine needles and twigs atop it. The problem with a fire in our current location was melting the more or less protective wall around us, not to mention the supportive base below it. The door would keep it out of the melting snow it created, and the cold air outside would keep our cave intact overnight. The temperature had dropped drastically the moment the sun started going down. I needed a light. I could have used the jet boil, but I needed to save as much of his butane as I could. Then I remembered Grover's lighter. I brushed away the snow, slid my hand into his jeans pocket, and fingered out the brass Sippo lighter. I clicked it open, making a sound that reminded me of Dean Martin and John Wayne, and thumbed the wheel. It lit. "Thank you, Grover." I turned it in my hand. Years in his pocket had scratched and worn it smooth. I held it up on one side and saw an engraving. It read, "A lamp unto my path." I lit the end of a twig, let the twig flame grow and climb toward my finger, and then fed it beneath the pine needles. Dead and dry, they caught quickly. Using the empty trail mix bag, I fed the fire, adding larger sticks as the fire popped and crackled and grew in size. She watched the paper bag turn to ash. That was good trail mix. The dog sensed the warmth, walked down to the end of Ashley's sleeping bag, and curled up in a puffy spot some 4 feet from the flame. The fire was a welcome addition. It improved our general disposition, which it darkened given the absence of food and the slim hope of finding it. I figured I could go a week and still function without food, provided we had water, but after that I'd be so weak I'd be no good to anyone. Years ago, when I saw that movie Alive, it grossed me out. Sitting there staring at Grover, it grossed me out more. I wasn't eating him. Having said that, if all options were honestly on the table, and it meant our living versus our dying, there was always the dog. Problem was, he'd only feed us once. Maybe the first time his size was ever an advantage to him. Had he been a lab or a Rottweiler, I'd have thought more seriously about it. We stared at the fire, letting our eyes grow lazy. Ashley broke the silence. "I've been thinking about what to get Vince for a wedding gift. I'm coming up blank. Got any ideas?" I fed tinder into the fire. "First anniversary, a cabin in the Colorado Rockies. Snowed in." I forced a laugh. "A little like this. We were paying off school loans. Didn't have 2 nickels to rub together, and, like our honeymoon, had agreed on a no-present anniversary." She laughed. "What'd you get her?"
"A purple orchid."
She nodded.
"Ah, hence the orchid and greenhouse thing."
I nodded.
"I like the way you talk about your wife. Sounds like you do life together."
She laid her head back.
"In the course of my job, I work with or meet a lot of people who don't, who treat their spouse like a roommate, somebody they cross paths with, split the mortgage with, maybe have kids with. Two people bent on individuality. It's refreshing to hear you talk about her. How'd you two meet?"
I rubbed my eyes. "Tomorrow, we need to try and get some sleep." I extended my hand. "Here, take this." She held out her palm.
"What is it?"
"Percocet."
"What's in it?"
"A combination of OxyContin and Tylenol."
"How many do you have?"
3.
"Why don't you take one?"
"I'm not in that much pain, and you will be come tomorrow and the next day. Go ahead. It'll help you sleep. And up here, where the air is half as thin, taking one is like taking 2.
"Meaning?"
"You'll feel the effects more."
"Will it help my headache?"
"Probably not. That's the altitude, mixed with the impact of the crash. But give that a day or so."
"Do you have a headache?"
"Yes." She rubbed her shoulders and the back of her neck. I'm starting to feel really stiff.
I nodded.
Whiplash.
She swallowed, and her eyes fell to Grover.
He sat, frozen, about 5 feet from the end of her bag, mostly covered in snow.
Can we do anything about him?
I need to bury him, but I can't move him. Moving me is tough enough right now.
When you breathe, you sound like you're in a lot of pain.
Get some rest. I'll be right outside.
One favor?
Sure.
I need to go again.
No worries.
This time was faster. Still no red tent, and there was a good bit of fluid. All good signs. I repacked snow around her leg, and she said,
You know, you can stop doing that any time you want. I'm freezing.
I felt her toes and the pulse in her ankle.
Hang in there.
If I let your leg warm up too much, we'll fall behind the pain curve, and...
I shook my head.
You don't want that. Not out here. I dug out some snow on her good side, creating a flat spot long enough for me, and laid my bag down alongside hers.
The temperature is dropping, and if we can share body heat, we'll both sleep better and live longer.
She nodded.
What time is it?
A little after 6. She lay back down, staring up.
I should be walking down the aisle.
I knelt next to her. Our breath was making smoke.
Ever been married before?
She shook her head, eyes tearing up.
I held up my sleeve and she leaned forward, wiping her tears on it.
I checked the stitches on her head and eye, and then pulled her cap gently back over her ears.
Her eyes were sunken, not quite as swollen, and her face had lost some of its puffiness.
You will. We are going to get off this mountain, and you are going to have your wedding.
Just a little later than you planned. She smiled and closed her eyes.
It was little consolation.
You'll look beautiful in white.
How do you know?
We had a small wedding.
How small?
Me, Rachel, and her folks.
You're right, that is small.
But the moment that door opened and she stood there, that white dress sweeping the ground, it's a picture a groom never forgets.
She turned her head.
Sorry, thought I was helping. An hour later, when her breathing had slowed, I crawled out and pulled a recorder from my pocket. The sky had leaned down, fire and crimson, to a sea of white etched with veins of silver, and was threatening to kiss the earth just as soon as the last rays of sun disappeared and tucked themselves behind the west. The dog followed and walked around me. He was light enough to walk on top of the frozen snow, but he didn't like it. He walked a few circles, lifted his leg next to a small tree, kicked some snow behind it like a charging bull, and then stared off across the plateau and mountaintops. After 2 or 3 seconds, he shook his head, sneezed, and disappeared back down the hole to curl up with Ashley. I pressed record.
Chapter 8.
Long day here. End of day 3, I think. We're alive, but staying that way is another thing. Ashley's hanging in there, but I don't know how or how long. If I had all the breaks and pain she had, I'd be curled up in the fetal position, begging somebody to thump me over the head or shoot me with enough morphine to numb a cow. She hasn't complained once.
Good news? I know where we are.
Bad news? It's a long way from anywhere, in terrain that's tough even with 2 good legs. Nearly improbable with 1 bad one.
I haven't told her that.
I know. I will.
I don't really know how we're going to get out of here. I can make some sort of stretcher out of pieces of the wing, but how far can I drag her on that? We need to find someplace lower, where we can rest up either until help comes, which I know it's not, or until I can walk us out of here. And we need food. It's been 48 hours since I ate anything other than some snack mix. Not to mention the dog, whose name I still can't remember. I know he's hungry, because he's chewing on tree limbs. He spends all his time shivering, and he doesn't like the snow. He walks around like it hurts his feet. I think I upset Ashley. I didn't mean to. I was trying to cheer her up. Maybe I'm out of practice.
Speaking of practice, you ever added up all the miles we ran together?
Me neither.
Seems like every time we ran, you'd ask me about your stride and I'd act serious like I was really paying attention. But in truth, I couldn't take my eyes off your legs.
I figure you knew that, too.
I loved running behind you. When I look back on us, on our beginnings, I'm reminded that we did something we loved and shared it. We never had to think of a reason to hang out, and nothing ever divided us. Once you got your driver's license, you'd drive to the beach, tap on my window at 4 a.m., and we'd take off running down the beach. Long runs, 10 to 12 miles. What we called LSD, long, slow distance, where time didn't matter. No stopwatch, no measurement of our success or failure. If we didn't run on the beach, I'd pick you up at the end of your drive and we'd run the bridges downtown. Over Main Street, through the landing, back over the Acosta, around the fountain and do it all over again. If one of us was tired, maybe fighting shin splints or just needing a break, we'd drive through Dunkin' Donuts, order two coffees, and tour the town with the top down. I think that's when I taught you how to drive a clutch, and you gave me whiplash. Okay, so maybe it wasn't that bad, but you did wear out my clutch, and my neck was sore. But I'd gladly teach you all over again. There was that Saturday morning. We were coming back up the beach after a long run. This kid on a surfboard out to our right caught a wave. The nose of his board dipped, and he started tumbling. He washed up on shore just in front of us. The two pieces of his board surfaced a few moments later. His forehead was cut, blood everywhere, shoulder out of socket, and he was disoriented and nauseous. I sat him down and put pressure on his head. He pointed to his house, and you ran to get his folks while I sat with him, helped him set his shoulder. When you returned, he was laughing, talking about what new board he was going to get. His folks thanked us, walked him home, and you turned to me, shading your eyes from the sun. You said it like you'd known it all your life. You were going to make a great doctor someday. What?
You.
You tapped me in the chest.
You're going to make a great doctor.
I'd never thought about it, to be honest. I'd never thought about doing anything other than getting out of my dad's house. But the moment you said it, something in me clicked.
How do you know?
The way you care for people, you made quotation notes with your fingers. Bedside manner.
What are you talking about?
You pointed at the kid walking away. Look at him. When I left, he was about to throw up. Now he's laughing, about to buy a new board. Can't wait to get back in the water.
That's you, Ben. Something about the way you talk soothes people.
It does?
A nod.
I should know. That was the first time I clued into the fact that you saw potential in the mundane, the insignificant, the ordinary. The second time occurred when I came to see you at work, volunteering after school as a candy striper at the children's hospital. Bald, sickly kids strewn everywhere. Oxygen tanks. Wheelchairs. Messy sheets. Uncomfortable smells. Disconcerting sounds. When I found you, you were rubber-gloved holding a bedpan, laughing with a little girl who moments before was sitting on top of it. You were all smiles. So was she. I saw sickness and misery tucked away in every room. Not you. You saw possibility and promise, even in the improbable. Somewhere in my junior year, I looked around and you had become my best friend. You taught me what it meant to smile, to live with a heart that felt alive. With every mile, you dug down into the quarry that had become me and chipped away at the scars and rocks piled up around my soul. You were the first to put together the pieces of me. When it came to love, you taught me to crawl, walk, run, and then, somewhere on that beach beneath the moon, and running into a headwind. Clipping away 5-minute miles, you turned to me, cut the ties that held my wings, and taught me to fly. My feet barely touching the ground. Staring out across this ice-capped landscape with nothing but the impossible staring back at me, I am reminded. I see what is. You see what could be. I need to get inside. It's getting colder. I miss you. Twice during the night, I repacked snow around Ashley's leg. She never woke, but moaned a lot and talked in her sleep. I had been up a few hours by the time she woke with what sounded like a painful cry. Her eyes were slits. How do you feel? Her voice sounded thick. Like I've been hit by a Mack truck. With that, she rolled on her side and vomited. She did that for several minutes. It was mostly dry heaves and stomach acid. Finally, she sat back, trying to catch her breath. She was in a lot of pain. I wiped her mouth and held the cup while she sipped. I've got to get some Advil in you, but I doubt your empty stomach is going to like it much. Eyes closed, she nodded. I added fuel to the fire and clicked on the jet boil. The smell of coffee opened her eyes. She was tired. Her energy was gone. How long you been up? Couple of hours. I did some looking around. While I like our cave, we need to get out of this hole. Nobody will ever see us, and it prevents me from lighting any kind of signal fire. She eyed the contraptions to my left. You make those? I had taken the netting off the backs of the seats, disassembled the wire and metal frames using Grover's Leatherman, and designed something that looked sort of like snowshoes. The frames were longer than they were wide, wider in the front and tapered in the rear. I double-folded the netting, stretched it over the frames, and attached the squares using several loops of Grover's fly line. They came together well. I held them up. Snowshoes. If you say so. Most mornings during scheduled surgery or late nights when an ambulance rolls in or life flight lands, I'm faced with something far more challenging than a pair of these. Are you bragging? No. I'm just saying that my day job prepares me for the unusual and unexpected. I handed her one and she turned it, studying it. She handed it back. I think any movement at all sounds painful, but I'm game to get out of here. A change of scenery would be nice. I poured coffee and handed it to her. Go easy on that. We've got about 2 days left. You're not expecting anyone, are you? I mean, seriously. No, I'm not. She nodded and breathed over the plastic cup. I'm going to leave you for a couple of hours. Walk around a bit. I dug Grover's flare gun out of the plastic box in the back where he kept his fishing tackle, loaded it, and handed it to Ashley. If you need me, cock this and squeeze this. And when you do, make sure it's pointed out that hole. Otherwise, you're liable to set yourself and this whole place on fire. There's still some gas in the tanks in the wing. I should be gone most of the day. If I'm not back at dark, don't worry. I'm taking my sleeping bag, bivy sack, emergency blanket, couple of other things. I'll be fine. Out here, conditions determine most everything. They can change quickly, and if they get bad, I might have to hunker down and wait it out. I'm going to try to find some sort of food and an alternate shelter, or someplace I can build one. You know how to do all this? I know how to do some of it. What I don't know, I'll learn. I unstrapped Grover's compound bow from its case in the tail of the plane, along with one of his fly rods, his vest, and one of the reels stuffed in it. You can fly fish? I've done it once. How'd you do? You mean, did I catch anything? She nodded. Nope. I was afraid you were going to say that. She eyed the bow. How about that contraption? This I've actually done. So you can hit stuff with it? Used to. You think your ribs will let you pull it back?
Don't know. Haven't tried yet.
So you're winging it?
Basically.
Before you go, will you help me with something?
Ashley went to the bathroom, and then I melted more water and got her covered up.
Will you hand me my case?
She pulled out her cell phone.
Just for kicks.
She turned it on, but the cold had killed it, too. I shrugged.
You could play solitaire.
I pointed at my small backpack that doubles as my briefcase. You're welcome to use my computer, but I doubt it'll turn on. And even if it does, I wouldn't give it very long.
Got any books?
A shrug. Not much of a reader. Guess you're alone with your thoughts. And the dog. I scratched his ears. He had grown comfortable with us, and had quit trying to lick Grover on the lips.
Can you remember his name?
She shook her head.
No.
Me either. I think we should call him Napoleon.
Why?
Just look at him. If ever an animal had a Napoleon complex, it's him. He's got the attitude of an angry bull mastiff, shoved into a package the size of a loaf of bread. He's the poster dog for it's not the size of the dog in the fight, but the size of the fight in the dog. She nodded.
Can we do anything for his feet?
I looked at the back seat that was leaning over, broken off its hinges, half deflated looking after I'd robbed it of part of its frame. I opened the Leatherman and cut four squares of the vinyl covering. A half inch of foam padding was stuck to the back. I cut slits in the corners, fed a piece of fly line through each, and tied them around Napoleon's feet. He looked at me like I'd lost my mind. He sniffed them, stood up, walked around on the snow, then leaned against me and licked my face.
Okay, I love you too.
Ashley smiled.
I think you've made a friend.
I held up my hand.
The GPS.
She slid it from beneath her sleeping bag, and I slid it into the inside pocket of my jacket. Lastly, I unzipped a small pocket on the side of my backpack, grabbed my compass, and hung it around my neck. It's lensatic or fluid-filled. Rachel gave it to me years ago. Ashley saw it and asked,
"What's that?"
I palmed it. The edges were smooth. Some of the green had given way to the dull aluminum beneath.
Compass.
Looks used. I shouldered my backpack, zipped up my jacket, pulled on my gloves, and lifted the bow. Remember, when it starts getting dark and I'm not back, remind yourself that I am coming back. It may be tomorrow morning, but I'll be here. Coffee date, you and me. Deal? She nodded. I knew when it was dark and I hadn't yet arrived, she'd start getting concerned, and her worries would populate in the shadows. Darkness does that. It speaks fear that, left alone, remains unspoken, yet real. Even if it's tomorrow morning? She nodded again. I pulled out the Advil bottle. Take 4 every 6 hours, and don't forget to feed the fire. I crawled out of our den, and Napoleon followed. I knelt to strap on the snowshoes, and he climbed on me.
I need you to stay here and take care of her, okay? Keep her company.
I think she's lonely, and it's not a very good day. She's supposed to be on her honeymoon now. Ashley hollered up out of the wreckage.
Yeah, someplace warm and where some guy named Julio or Francois wearing white linen pants and a bronze tan brings me tall drinks decorated with umbrellas.
I turned and began walking up the mountain.
Chapter 9.
My senior year, state championships. You watched me win the 400 in a new state record, breaking the 50-second barrier. We'd set a new state record in the 4x400. I'd won the 2-mile just seconds off a national record, and I was standing at the start line of the mile. They had rearranged the meet, holding the mile last to garner enough media attention. Somebody had started a rumor that I could run 4 minutes. Coaches from around the country were standing around Dad, patting him on the back.
At last count, I had over 20 Division I scholarship offers, full rides. I had my piles, and Dad had his. His prized pile, centered around MBAs and finance.
They'll pay for 5 years of education. Get your BA in 2.5, then your MBA. Once you're out of school, you can write your own ticket. With your drive, you could run my agency.
I wanted nothing to do with him, his markets, or his agency, and I knew where he could stick it. I just never told him. You had 2 Division I offers, and truth be told, I was more proud of yours than mine. I could see his face out of the corner of my eye. The vein had popped out of the side of his head, just above his right temple. Sweat was pouring off him. I'd run 4 minutes and 4 seconds several mornings on the beach, but that was on sand and a partial headwind. He was sure I could run 3 minutes and 58 seconds. Toe on the line, I was spent. My legs were jelly. I'd be lucky to run 4 minutes and 5 seconds. You hung on the fence, hands clutched. The gun sounded. After the first lap, we were still together, a tight group. Some guy from down south was trying to elbow me out. I knew if I was going to do anything, I had to get away from these guys. By the start of the third lap, I was all alone. The organizers had offered a pacer, but Dad had declined. He'll earn this himself. 3 laps in, and I was on pace. I had it, and I knew I had it. People in the stands were on their feet, screaming. I remember a lady shaking a milk jug filled with 6 pennies. Dad was stone-faced, granite with inflatable lungs. 100 meters to go, and I was looking at 3 minutes 58 seconds, maybe 3 minutes 57 seconds. I watched him watching me. Everything I'd ever worked for was coming true in those few seconds. You were screaming at the top of your lungs, jumping 3 feet off the ground. Watching you, watching him, it struck me that no matter what time I turned in, it wouldn't be good enough for him, national record or not. He would always assume that I had not tried hard enough, that I could always run faster. Something about his Rushmore face cut something loose in me. I eased up. Slowed. I watched the clock roll through 3 minutes 53 seconds, then 3:57. My official time would be 4 minutes and 37 hundredths of a second. The place went crazy. I'd done something no other Florida runner had ever done. 4-year state champion in 12 events, headed to the national championships, and, because I also carried a 4.0 GPA, any college I chose. I stood on the track, swarmed by my teammates. But I didn't care. The only face I wanted to see was yours. And then you found me. I never saw my dad. I'm pretty sure I had another 5 seconds in my legs. And I'm pretty sure he knew that, too. We were going out, the whole team, to celebrate. I came home to change. We walked in. He was sitting in his chair, an empty crystal glass on his thigh, the bottle half-empty next to him. Brown liquor. He seldom drank, considered it something lesser weak people did. You peered around me. "Mr. Payne, did you see?" He stood, pointed his finger in my face, poked me in the chest, spit gathered in the corner of his mouth, a vein throbbed beneath his eye. "Nobody ever gave me nothing, you son of a—" He shook his head, balled his fist, and swung. The blow broke my nose. Felt like a blood-filled balloon had exploded inside my face. By then I was 6'2", 2 inches taller than him, and I knew if I swung back, I might never stop. But when I stood up, he was raising his hand over you. And judging by the look on his face, he blamed you for me. I caught his hand, spun him, and threw him into the sliding glass door. Tempered glass, it shattered into 1 million square pieces. He lay on the deck, staring at me. You drove me to the hospital where they set my nose, scrubbed the blood off my face and neck, and congratulated me.
One of the orderlies handed me the front page of the paper, covered with a full-page picture of me, and asked for my autograph. Around midnight, we drove to a village inn, a 24-hour pancake place, and ordered one piece of French silk pie and two forks. Our celebration. Then I drove you home where your mom met us, and we all sat at the kitchen table, talking back through the meat. You sat at the table, sleep in your eyes, wrapped in a terry cloth robe, and your leg touching mine. Your legs had touched mine 100 times at the track or in the car or anywhere. But this was different. This was intentional. This was not Rachel, the runner's leg, touching mine. This was Rachel, the girl's leg, touching mine. Big difference. I got home around 1. A few hours later, 4:55 a.m. arrived, and Dad did not. He never woke me again. I lay awake, listening for footsteps, wondering what to do, who to be. I couldn't answer that, so I dressed and went for a walk on the beach, watching the sun come up over the shrimp boats. I walked through lunch, on toward dinner. The sun was falling when I quit walking at the jetties in Mayport, some 20 miles north of where I'd started. I climbed on the rocks and then climbed out toward the end of the jetties. Some might say that's dangerous. Your voice sounded behind me. What are you running from? How did you get out here? Walked. How did you find me? Follow the footprints. Kind of dangerous, don't you think? You smiled. Knew I wouldn't be alone. You climbed up another rock, fiddler crabs scurrying beneath you, stood, and pulled me to you. You lifted your glasses. Costa del Mars. I'd given them to you. Your eyes were red. You'd been crying. Arms crossed, you stared out across the water, hands hidden inside the long gray sleeves of your sweatshirt. You think they'll care that we cut class? I don't. I palmed away a tear. You've been crying. You nodded. Why? You pounded my chest, then leaned against me. 'Cause I don't want it to end. What? Your eyes welled again. A tear hung on your chin. I brushed it gently with the top of my hand. Us, dummy. You placed your hand flat against my chest. Seeing you. Every day. Oh. That. Maybe that's what really had me walking up the beach. And in over 20 miles I found no easy answer. We were both about to hurt a whole lot. High school love was one thing. But choosing a college because of that high school love was something everyone cautioned you and me against. Remember? Sometimes I wish we'd listened to them. Then I shake my head and think, not so. I don't blame us. I'd do it again. Honest, I would. If I could fly back in time, I'd make the same choice. But sometimes I wonder. Chapter 10. The storm had dumped 3 feet of snow, all fresh powder. Without the shoes, I'd have been thigh-deep, wet, and the cold would be stinging my legs. Wouldn't be long before they were numb. I made a mental note that if things went bad and I started tumbling, don't lose the snowshoes. Given that, I stopped, cut 2 tethers or cords, and tied one end to the back of each snowshoe, and the other end around each ankle. Sort of like a surfer's leash. Despite the fact that we needed to lose elevation, I first needed to gain it to get a bird's-eye view of where we were in relation to everything else. Once I got a better view, I could turn on the GPS and start relating it to what I saw. The air was thin, the surface was covered with a slick sheet of ice. I had to keep taking off and putting on the snowshoes, and I was much weaker than I expected. I climbed through lunch and into the afternoon before I summited a small ridgeline that rose up over the plateau, maybe 1,000 feet above the crash site. It was late afternoon by the time I got the view I'd been hoping for. What I saw did not soothe me. I was hoping for any sign of civilization, a light, smoke from a fireplace, a structure of some sort,
anything to give me a direction, a reason for hope. I turned, scanning the horizon, and the truth set in. We were in the middle of nowhere. I saw nothing that was man-made. It was a desolate, snow-covered landscape, etched with jagged peaks and impossible routes that stretched 60 or 70 miles in every direction. Look up remote in the dictionary, and you'd see a picture of me standing on that rock. I turned on the GPS and oriented myself, confirming what my eyes told me, using the compass to confirm the directions and degrees the electronic unit was telling me. The only surprise was the number of lakes and streams showing on the screen. There were hundreds, maybe 1,000. All had to be frozen this time of year. But I noted the few that were closest and logged that away as tomorrow's investigation. In the far southeast corner of the screen, I saw a dim trail suggesting a logging road or a snowmobile trail. It wound up or down a pass and between two mountain ranges. I stared off in that direction but saw nothing but treetops and jagged rock. I oriented the GPS with the surrounding peaks and took a reading with my compass. At this distance, a miscalculation of only 1 degree can set you off course by several miles. I was in the process of zooming in when the screen on the GPS flickered to black. I tapped it on the side, as if that would do any good. But it was dead. The cold had killed it and drained the battery. I closed my eyes, tried to remember everything I'd seen on the screen, and adding to that sketch I'd made yesterday outside the wreck. It was incomplete and lacking, but better than a blank slate. I started back after dark. I was tired, and all I wanted to do was lie down and sleep. But the thought of Ashley wide-eyed and worried kept me putting one foot in front of the other. No matter how much I tried to prepare her for my late arrival, I knew as soon as the sun went down she'd started listening for my return, and every minute that passed would feel like an hour. Waiting for somebody does that. It turns minutes to hours, hours to days, and days to several lifetimes. Chapter 11. For a minute I thought we'd had our last conversation. This thing wouldn't turn on, no green light, no red light, no nothing. For the last 5 minutes I've been pressing every button it has, jiggled the batteries, even pulled them out and turned them around. Finally, I slid it inside my shirt and pressed it to my chest for several minutes, warming it slowly. If this thing had quit, I don't know. Not sure how I'd react. In football, they called it piling on. In track, we called it hitting the wall. I remember calling the track coach and asking him to look at your tapes and your times. He didn't skip a beat. Would that influence your decision to attend this institution? Yes, it would. I heard some paper shuffling. Funny, I just happened to have an extra scholarship lying on my desk. Just like that. I look back on college, and I think those were some of the best of days. My dad was out of the picture, and we were free to be us. To grow together, to laugh together. And you found your rhythm and became the runner I knew you could be. I was just glad to have a hand in it. Our final year in school, med school on the horizon, my track career coming to a close, medals hanging on the wall or stuffed in a drawer somewhere. To my knowledge, Dad never came to see me run. But inside me, running had changed. It was no longer my thing, it was our thing. I liked it better that way. You're the best training partner I've ever had. Plus, we'd found the Rockies, and that gave us an outlet, became our thing, too. You'd been quiet a few days. I thought you were busy, distracted with school or exams or... I didn't know you were thinking about us, you and me. Honey, I can't read your mind. Couldn't then. Can't now. We were home for spring break. Your folks were glad to have you back in the house. Dad had moved to Connecticut to run another firm. Kept the condo in Florida to maintain residency. I had it all to myself. We'd just finished running. The sun was going down. Breeze was picking up. Sweat trickled down your arms. One bead was hanging off the lobe of your left ear. You sat down, took off your shoes, and let the water roll over your feet. Finally, you turned to me, a wrinkle between your eyes, a vein throbbing in your neck and one on your temple. You stiffened.
What's your problem?
I looked around. Didn't know I had one.
Well, you do.
Honey, I'm... You turned away, rested your elbows on your knees and shook your head.
What have I got to do?
I tried sitting next to you and you pushed me away.
What are you talking about?
You started to cry.
I'm talking about us.
You poked me in the chest.
You and me.
I like us just the way we are. I'm not going anywhere.
That's just it.
You shook your head. You're about as dumb as a bag of hammers.
Rachel, what are you talking about?
Tears were pouring down. You stood up, hands on your hips, and stepped back.
I want to get married, you and me. I want you all to myself.
Forever.
Well, I do too. I mean, I want you.
You crossed your arms.
Ben, you got to ask first.
That's when it hit me.
Is that what this is all about?
You palmed a tear and looked away.
Honey.
I knelt, held your hand, waves rolling over my shins. You started to smile. The minnows were nibbling on your toes. Tiny shells stuck to your skin. Laughter bubbled up. I tried to get the words out, but my tears got in the way.
Rachel Hunt?
The smile spread across your face. I hurt when I'm not with you. I ache in places I didn't know my heart went. I don't know what kind of man I'll be, or doctor, or husband. And I know I seldom say the words you need to hear, but I know I love you. With all of me, you are the glue that holds me together. Spend forever with me. Marry me, please.
You wrapped your arms around me and we fell.
The sand and water and foam swallowed us, and you kissed me. Tears and salt and laughter, and you were nodding. That was a good day. A good memory.
Chapter 12. It was midnight by the time I got back to the plane. Napoleon heard me, poked his head out, and then disappeared again. The temperature had dropped back down to single digits, which meant my pant legs were frozen. I was cold down to my bones. I snapped off some dead limbs, shook off the snow, and carried them back into the hole. The snow was starting again. I'd only peed once the entire day, and even then not much, which told me I'd not had enough fluid. I had some catching up to do. Standing there, I watched Napoleon disappear and noticed how his covered feet made small indentations in the snow. Only then did I notice the larger tracks alongside his leading to and from our cave. I'm no expert on tracks, but my first thought was mountain lion. The tracks came out of some rocks above us, wound down a snowdrift and up to the entrance where I'd been crawling in and out. I also noticed a small, burrowed area where it looked like something had been sitting or lying down, as in lying in wait. Didn't take me long to make sense of it. Dead people smell, even frozen dead people. So do injured people and little dogs. I had to get out of my wet clothes, so I stoked the fire, stripped, spread out my clothes, and climbed naked but for my underwear inside my bag. I was shivering, and my fingers were stiff as though they'd been dipped in wax. I dropped some snow in the jet boil and clicked it on. Ashley watched me. Her eyes betrayed anxiety. I curled up in my bag and let myself shiver, trying to create some heat.
Hey.
Her eyes were tired. She was suffering, and it showed in her eyes. She took a deep breath.
Hi.
Her voice was weak.
Taken anything lately?
She shook her head. I placed a Percocet on her tongue, and she sipped the last of her water.
You don't look too good, she offered.
Why don't you take some of the Advil?
I knew if I didn't, I might not get out of my bag tomorrow.
Okay.
I held up two popsicle-ish fingers.
Two.
She poured them into my hand, and I swallowed.
What did you see?
There's a level one trauma center just a few hundred meters from here. I flagged down the EMTs. They're pulling a gurney down here now. I talked to the hospital administrator and secured a private room for you. Should have you up, showered, warm, and pumped full of IV pain medication in 10 minutes or less. Oh, and I talked to Vince. He'll be waiting on you when you get there.
That bad, huh?
I slid down further into my bag. Nothing but snow, ice, rock, and mountain, as far as I can see.
And the GPS?
Same picture. She lay back and let out a deep breath, the one she'd been holding all day. I poured some warm water and started sipping.
Got any ideas?
Well, there are some lakes down below us, a few streams. I'm sure they're all frozen, but I thought I'd see if I could make my way down tomorrow and find some fish. Tomorrow makes 5 days since the crash, and 4 with no food. She closed her eyes and focused on her breathing. How's the leg feeling?
Hurts.
I slid over, packed snow around it, and saw that while the swelling had gone down, her skin was a deep purple from the top of her knee to the side of her hip. I clicked on my flashlight, checked her stitches and then her pupils for responsiveness. They were slow and fatigued quickly, which meant her body was weak and the elevation was starting to take a toll. I fed the fire and felt her toes. They were cold, which was bad. Circulation was becoming a problem. By treating the leg with constant ice, I was compromising the foot or toes. I had to get some blood flow in that foot. I turned so we were face to toes. I unzipped my bag, and without moving her leg, sat pressing my chest and stomach to the bottom of her foot. Then I wrapped us both in the bag. She focused on her breathing. Staring up through the tarp and tree limbs, large flakes weighted everything and muted the world.
I was scheduled for a pedicure yesterday. Or was it the day before?
Sorry. Fresh out of polish.
Rain check?
I wrapped my palm across the top of her foot. When we get out of here, and you're warm in some hospital bed and not lying on a bed of ice, provided you don't sue me for putting you in danger the day before your wedding, I'll paint your toenails whatever color you like.
Funny you should mention that.
I've been lying here since you left, drafting my attorney's opening argument. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury.
How's it coming together?
She shrugged.
If I were you, I'd hire a very good lawyer, and even then I wouldn't get my hopes up.
That bad? Her head fell to one side.
Let's see. You started with good intentions, then saved my life, and despite the fact that I've seen you cough up blood at least twice, you set my leg and really haven't left my side.
You saw that?
Blood on snow, hard to miss.
We'll both get better when we lose a few thousand feet. Ashley stared at the compass hanging from my neck.
When did she give you that?
Loggerhead turtles lay their eggs along our beach, leaving these big mounds up in the dunes. Years ago, Rachel nominated herself the Turtle Patrol. She'd circle the mounds with stakes and pink surveyor tape, and then mark off the days on a calendar. She was amazed every time the turtles hatched and knew, somehow, to head for the water. I've always been pretty good with directions. Can find my way around most anywhere. She gave it to me 1 year after watching a particular nest hatch.
Why not just get a GPS like Grover's?
Well, the problem with a GPS is that batteries run dead and they don't like cold weather. Most times, on long hikes, I walk with a GPS clipped to one strap and my compass hung around my neck.
This may sound stupid, but how does a compass know which way to point?
Actually, it only points one way, magnetic north. We find what we need off of that.
Magnetic north?
Her foot was starting to warm. You didn't do Girl Scouts, did you?
She shook her head. Too busy kicking people.
The Earth is magnetized. The source of that is up near the North Pole.
That's why it's called Magnetic North.
So?